Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our correspondent will speak with us about a UN Secretary General that has died. We'll have expert reaction to four oil nations agreeing to freeze oil output. We'll get an update on the American run for the White House. And we'll have details of who won what at the Grammys.
Well, of course, we have to congratulate Taylor Swift. This was her year.
It's All Right Here coming up on The Voice of America. Former UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has died at the age of 93. Correspondent Mohammed El-Shenawy joins us now, and welcome, Mohammed.
Thank you.
Say, Mohammed, you are familiar with the legacy of the late veteran Egyptian diplomat. What can you tell us about him?
Well, Sue, I was lucky to meet with him several times. I met him first time when I was a student in Cairo University, and he was then a prominent professor of political science at the university. Then I interviewed him for The Voice of America when he was Egyptian foreign minister, and in both encounters he was very impressive and very warm personality. The third time I saw him personally was at the White House when I was covering the Camp David Accords signing, and Egyptian President Sadat, Prime Minister Menachem Begin of Israel, and President Jimmy Carter signed the 1979 treaty, ending a 31 state of war between Egypt and Israel, which is a breakthrough in the history of the Middle East conflict. On the professional side, Boutros-Ghali was a very shrewd diplomat, and his reputation enabled him to be the first Arab to serve as a UN chief. He took office in 1992 at a time of increasing influence for the United Nations, and also during one of its most difficult times, with crises in Somalia, Rwanda, the Middle East, and former Yugoslavia, and he served 1 5-year term. While he had said earlier that he will not seek a second term as a Secretary General, he ran again. And late in 1996, Security Council voted to give him another term. But U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, in her last days as an American delegate to the Security Council, casted a decisive veto as one of the five permanent council members, and Boutros-Ghali thus became the only Secretary General to be denied a second term.
Well, Mohammed, what about his personal upbringing in Egypt?
Well, he was born on November 14, 1922, into a Coptic Christian family in Cairo. He was married to a Jewish French lady, and was educated at Cairo University and then in Paris, where he established a long life connection with France. He studied international relations at Columbia University in New York and became Egypt's foreign minister in 1977. After leaving the UN, Boutros-Ghali served from 1998 to 2002 as a Secretary General of the Franconi, a group of French-speaking nations, and in 2004 he was named the President of Egypt's new Human Rights Council, a body created then by Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak amid U.S. pressure on Arab nations for some sort of democratic reform.
Well, thank you, Mohammed, for that information and sharing your personal story of meeting him.
Thank you.
And with a look at what's happening on the web about that story is VOA's Michael Lippin, who is also joining us here at the Anchor Desk. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, Susan. Well, there are a lot of tributes coming in for Boutros Boutros-Ghali on Twitter. The New York Times is remembering him this way. The New York Times tweeted today that Boutros-Ghali accompanied Egyptian President Anwar Sadat on his historic mission to Jerusalem and played a pivotal role in the Camp David Accords. The New York Times also tweets that Boutros Boutros-Ghali led the United Nations as it struggled to deal with genocide in Rwanda and Bosnia. Now, on a lighter note, a lot of people are also posting tweets about how Boutros Boutros-Ghali was a subject of pop culture in the 1990s and the 2000s. And I'll give you two examples. One is a skit on the American TV comedy Seinfeld, in which Jerry Seinfeld and some of his friends are remarking about a topless woman off camera. And, you know, Kramer says, "Yo, yo, ma," as he expresses surprise about seeing a topless woman. And then Jerry Seinfeld says, "Boutros, Boutros, golly."
And that is pretty good.
Basically, the word golly in American slang is a way of expressing surprise. And Boutros, Boutros, golly's last name has the word golly in it. It's spelled differently, though. Another example, just quickly, is how there was a British comedian called Sacha Baron Cohen. He had a show called The Ali G Show. And there was a skit of Ali G interviewing Boutros Boutros-Ghali in 2003. And Boutros Boutros-Ghali knew that this was a comedy, but he went along with it. He was very good humored. And he let himself be interviewed by Ali G, who asked him questions like, "Is Disneyland a member of the United Nations?" And of course, Boutros Boutros-Ghali had to say, "No, Disneyland is not a member of the UN. It's just for kids." Back
well, you. Thank you, Michael. And that sounds very much like your experience too, doesn't it, Mohammed?
Actually, he reminded me of another social thing that happened with Boutros Ghali when he was in New York. A famous ice cream maker put a new brand called Boutros Boutros Garlic.
Oh,
that was a funny thing too.
That's clever.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael. Thank you, Mohammed. And you're listening to VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A new study from researchers at Rutgers University in New Jersey has found that a combination of meditation and aerobic exercise can help reduce depression. A group of male and female student volunteers, some with a diagnosis of depression and others who were mentally healthy, completed a twice-weekly 8-week program that included a half hour of focused attention meditation followed by another half hour of aerobic exercise. The study found that the combination of mental and physical training reduced the symptoms of depression in the student volunteer group by 40%. Along with its work with the student volunteers, the researchers provided the same training to young and formerly homeless mothers who initially had symptoms of depression and anxiety. But after 8 weeks of mind-body training, they said that their depression and anxiety had lessened, felt more motivated, and were able to have a more positive focus on their lives. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Four of the world's biggest oil-producing nations have reached an agreement to freeze output. The decision by Russia, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Qatar comes after a 19-month decline in prices that has sent oil falling below $30 a barrel for the first time in over a decade. Molly Williamson is an energy expert with the Middle East Institute, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's nice to have you. What is your reaction to this news today?
I'm skeptical. It is the case that people would like to have stability in prices of this very important and volatile commodity, but getting to that stability is going to be quite the challenge. It requires everybody to coordinate and cooperate, and that is not the history of this commodity in terms of price stability.
Why do you think these nations agree to this at this time?
Oh, I think for varying reasons. They would like to get a process going and explore whether or not it is possible by controlling production to bring some stability to prices. But Venezuela's urgent problem is very, very urgent. They're trying to make it to lunchtime. Russia's urgency is also a function of its international standing. The challenges are that not only are they all operating in very different time zones in terms of their priorities and their requirements, but no two time zones are the same. So they're relying on trying to get the Saudis to pump less and to make this commodity more dear, more scarce, more valuable. But there is a huge glut in the marketplace right now. And expectations are that it would take a lot of time to use up that glut even if everybody cooperated. And as I say, historically, there's not a lot of cooperation.
Oil prices and stock prices sometimes seem intertwined. Do you think this decision on oil, if it goes into effect, might have a longer-term effect on stocks?
Well, it would certainly give people more a sense of calm and a greater sense of confidence that commodity volatility is somehow getting under control. It's not just oil, but it certainly is a major seen as a major indicator. But the reality is that there are a lot of moving parts in this machine we call a global economy, and it's not likely that any one factor or any one agreement can control that global economy.
Well, thank you very much, Molly, for your time today.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on International Edition, a look at the race for the White House. And what's the lowdown at the Grammys? There are only 5 days to go before Nevada's Democratic caucus, where Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are facing off. Following the action is senior national correspondent Jim Malone, who joins us here in the studio. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Susan.
Hey, where does this competition between the two Democratic candidates stand?
Well, I would say in Nevada, it's tighter than expected at the moment. Hillary Clinton had a big advantage in the polling there for several months. But the success of Bernie Sanders, especially in the recent New Hampshire primary, his ability to appeal to young Democratic voters and progressives, is starting to churn in Nevada as well. And so I think the Clinton camp is girding for a very close race there. That's a caucus, by the way, not a primary. So the caucus votes, where people actually have to come out to local meetings, can be harder to predict. But certainly the Clinton camp thought they were in good shape because we're starting to get into states where it's just not predominantly white voters taking part. We have Hispanics in Nevada, and of course, we have a lot of African Americans who will be taking part in the primaries in South Carolina.
Generally, what is Nevada like? Is it a conservative state or more liberal?
No, Nevada generally is what we call one of our battleground states now. It's kind of split. Democrats are strong in the cities, especially around Las Vegas, especially with unions. Think of all the people who work in the casinos there. So that's a huge area for Democratic candidates to appeal to. But then again, once you get outside the cities into the suburbs, like many of these battleground states, it turns more conservative. So it's kind of a classic battleground state at the moment.
And they have had their problems. Unemployment, the housing industry, they've
been rough.
Yeah,
let me tell you, we went there, some of our colleagues, a few years after the recession hit. We're doing stories on the Tea Party, and it was really noticeable in Las Vegas because when Americans don't have money to travel for vacations and those nice casinos and have fun, that's the first place that gets hit. So the housing market there was terrible. So, yes, they've seen a lot of boom and bust over the years.
Okay, well, let's change a little bit. And the Republicans will have their next test in South Carolina. And there are six people still running in that contest.
Yeah, there are. We're looking at four or five for sure. And based on the most recent Republican debate, this battle has really turned nasty and is very personal. But if you look at the polling, Donald Trump is leading the pack in South Carolina. Look, South Carolina is historically important in the primary process for Republicans. Only once since 1980 has the winner in South Carolina not gone on to the nomination. So it's usually a pretty big indicator. I think particularly Jeb Bush is looking to South Carolina to keep his campaign going. He's brought in his brother, former President George W. Bush, to try to rally the troops. But he and Donald Trump really went at it in the debate. I'm not sure if one or the other emerged unscathed from that. And then you have Ted Cruz, who's sort of running second to Trump, though in the latest polls, Marco Rubio is kind of moving up to tie Cruz. So a clear lead for Trump. Will there be any lasting damage from the debate and his insults? We don't know.
And Trump seems to have pulled down his rhetoric a little bit as far as the bad language goes. He's cleaned it up a little bit.
Yeah, that perhaps. But he's not backing away from some of the claims on the George W. Bush administration. He keeps bringing up the fact the Twin Towers fell, referring to the 9/11 attacks. on George W. Bush's watch. Some of the comments and, you know, criticisms you're hearing out of Trump mirrored some from very liberal Democrats who were criticizing the Bush administration back in the day. You would think that would create some unease among Republican voters, but this anger, frustration we have talked about before that seems to fuel the Trump candidacy shows no signs of abating.
And one topic that really got all the candidates on both parties talking recently is filling a Supreme Court seat that was suddenly empty with the unfortunate death of Justice Antonin Scalia, who was a conservative.
Oh, yeah. This is a huge moment now. The court is split, and Scalia's passing means that if President Obama were able to appoint a liberal, the court would swing the other way after many years of being basically a right-of-center court. It could be left-of-center. That's why you're seeing such a visceral reaction from Republicans in Washington. They do not want to give President Obama this opportunity, even though under the Constitution, clearly it's his obligation to nominate someone. So now we're going to have this political battle over whether he can even nominate someone, and if he does, will they even get a fair hearing or a vote in the Senate? But all the Republicans are lined up on this. They do not want to risk the president choosing a successor to Antonin Scalia, who was the conservative giant on the Supreme Court for more than 30 years.
Well, thank you very much, Jim, for stopping by, and we'll see you again soon, I'm sure.
I look forward to it.
This is VOA.
This is Greenbeat for a healthier planet.
Wild Scyrian horses once numbered in the thousands on the small Greek island of Skyros. But these small, sturdy horses are now under threat of extinction, with about 280 pure Skyrians left. Make that 281. Amanda Simpson Katsarilias of the Skyros Island Horse Trust just welcomed a new foal into the world.
She has the right height, the right conformation, the right coloring. Alongside of that, you're also looking for a pony that could survive on the mountain.
Katsarilias, along with her partner, co-founded the Skyros Island Horse Trust to try to preserve the breed, and they now have 48 of the horses in their care. Skyrians differ from other Greek horses as they are especially small, measuring not more than 116 centimeters tall. The horse's presence on the island is said to date back to the Trojan War, but habitat loss and interbreeding with domestic horses caused the numbers to drop dramatically. Rebecca Ward for VOA's Greenbeat.
It was the recording industry's biggest night of the year, the Grammy Awards, held in Los Angeles, California. VOA Music's Ray McDonald and Shauna Renee have details.
The 2016 Grammy Awards are now history, and some of pop's best-known singers added to their trophy case. And in other cases, some up-and-coming performers earned their first Grammys. So, Shauna, what were some of the highlights of Monday night's show?
Well, of course, we have to congratulate Taylor Swift. This was her year. 2015, of course, was her year. She had the huge album 1989, which, by the way, won for Album of the Year.
This was Taylor's second Album of the Year Grammy. Back in 2010, she also won for Fearless.
And she made note of that in her acceptance speech, saying that she's actually the first woman to ever win that award twice. So, and had wonderful things to say and wonderful pieces of advice for young women coming up in the business. So we're congratulating her. Also, I think congratulations is in order for Justin Bieber. He won his very first Grammy this year with Skrillex and Diplo.
That's right. Where Are You Now?
And also performed during the show as well.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And congratulations to Kendrick Lamar. He was the man of the night with 11 nominations, and we were all wondering how many he would take home. Turns out he won 5, including Best Rap Album, and then he and Taylor Swift also won for Best Music Video.
And I think he also turned in the best performance of the night. It was an absolutely electrifying performance that started with him in chains and ended with him in absolute triumph. It just electrified the audience.
Oh, yeah. I think that, and I think Lady Gaga's tribute to David Bowie, probably the two best of the evening.
Lady Gaga says that David Bowie was a real influence on her, and I think it was a real labor of love for her to run through some of his greatest songs. Also, we should note that Meghan Trainor got the nod for Best New Artist, and Meghan was a songwriter before she became a performer, as was Bruno Mars, who took Record of the Year for his collaboration with Mark Ronson, Uptown Funk.
And I think they also won for Best Duo Performance, so he got a couple.
I think Uptown Funk was the soundtrack to the summer of 2015, so I think it was very fitting that that took the Record of the Year award.
And I thought it was wonderful that Mark Ronson, in his acceptance speech, called out George Clinton, who is the father of funk, which is that sound, that Uptown Funk sound, and then also a number of the other artists who are responsible for that sound that he borrowed for such a successful song last year.
All in all, I would say it was a pretty fascinating and satisfying evening, and now it will be on to the 2017 Grammys. Who will win next year? I'm Ray McDonald.
I am the Lady DJ, Shauna Renee.
As we heard, Taylor Swift won for Album of the Year for 1989. So here is one of the hit songs from her album, Wildest Dreams.
He said, let's get out of this town, drive out of the city, away from the crowds. I thought heaven can't help me now, nothing lasts forever. This is gonna take me down. He's so tall and handsome as hell. He's so bad, but he does it so well. I can see the end as it begins. My one condition is, say you'll remember me, standing in a nice dress, staring at the sunset, babe. Red lips and rosy cheeks. Say you'll see me again, even if it's just in your said, no one has to know what we do.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us today.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The 22nd Amendment to the United States Constitution, ratified in 1951, states that no person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of the president more than once. The amendment resolved an issue that Americans had debated since the founding of the Republic. Should there be a limit on the number of terms any individual can serve as President of the United States? The U.S. Constitution, as adopted in 1789, set no term limits for the office of the President. But many Americans feared that a popular leader, if continually reelected, might become corrupt or oppressive. Thomas Jefferson, the author of the Declaration of Independence, was troubled by the Constitution's omission of term limits. The feature I dislike, he wrote, and greatly dislike, is the abandonment in every instance of the necessity of rotation in office, and most particularly in the case of the president. America's first president, George Washington, chose to limit his time in office to 2 terms. A precedent followed until the election of Franklin D. Roosevelt to a 3rd term in 1940 and a 4th term in 1944. His death in 1945, early in his 4th term, reignited the debate about the ability of persons continually reelected to the presidency to serve effectively. As President Barack Obama noted in his address at the African Union in July, South Africa's Nelson Mandela and America's George Washington forged a lasting legacy, not only because of what they did in office, but because they were willing to leave office and transfer power peacefully. peacefully.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.